for Sunday morning's class. So we'll close out Judges, or we'll close out Gideon this evening. All right. As we talked about on Sunday, Gideon did gain a great victory over Midian, fighting the Midianites, with a very, very small little group of men, 300. And he was going against 135,000. But this chapter gives us the aftermath of that, and there are some statements. There's even, I think, some implications toward the end of this chapter that may indicate some events that sort of put a damper on this victory. Some on the part of Gideon's brethren, and we'll talk about that. Some on the part of outsiders, and even some on the part of Gideon himself. And we'll cover these three areas in class this evening. All right, let's look at the first three verses, and verses 1 through 3 connect back, of course, to verses 24 and 25 of chapter 7. So that's how the chapters will overlap one another. What happened in chapter 7, verses 24 and 25, as that chapter came to a close? What were the events that were taking place? Okay, right. Verse 24, the Bible says that Gideon sent a message out throughout Ephraim saying, go down and we'll just paraphrase, take the Jordan, cut off the escape route of the Midianites who are fleeing to the east, trying to escape us chasing them. And Ephraim did cut off Midian's escape route at the Jordan, and they captured Oreb and Zeb, two Midianite princes or kings, cut their heads off, executed them. And so they did just as Gideon asked them to do. Now we come to verses 1 through 3 of chapter 8, particularly verse 1. Then the men of Ephraim said to him, that's Gideon, what is this thing you have done to us, not calling us when you went to fight against Midian? And they contended with him vigorously, my version says. So their complaint basically was what? You didn't use us enough. You didn't call us. You didn't let us join in the glory of the victory. And though it's not stated, what else might they have wanted? The spoils. That's right. The booty from the war. They would have wanted the spoils, the riches that you gain when you defeat somebody. I think that would certainly be, I won't say necessarily implied, but I think strongly implied. That's typically what happens. So they vigorously complained that they had been underutilized in the battle. Well, how did Gideon effectively and tactfully deal with this situation? Yeah, he didn't say, well, just pipe down and be quiet. He didn't say that. He didn't say them to get over it. He said, he praised their efforts. What have I done now in comparison with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer, which that was his father's house. God has given the leaders of Midian, Oreb and Zeb, into your hands, and what was I able to do in comparison with you? So he praises, he calls their efforts the gleanings. Now, there's some reason for the use of these words. What is a gleaning? What was gleaning? Yeah, when the harvest time came to bring the crop in out of the field, the fact the law said to do what? You leave the corners of the field for who? The poor, the widows, the orphans, so forth, and let them glean. You let them have something to sustain themselves. And so gleanings were, we might call them leftovers, we might call them things that were of the last sort, if you will. Well, what were the gleanings in this instance? It wasn't a literal crop, of course. Okay. All right. Ephraim's gleanings were the fact that they sort of helped mop up after the victory. They helped capture the fleeing Midianites. They beheaded the two princes. And so that was gleanings, Gideon called them. And he says, your gleanings are better than, and my version uses the word vintage. Does your version use that? Better than the vintage of Abiezer, the harvest, or the initial slaughtering. So he's basically saying, your contribution in this thing is a lot greater than you realize. Could he be saying, we wouldn't be able to say we've achieved this great victory unless you had done your part? I mean, you've really made a worthwhile contribution to this military effort, if you will. So I chose the words he's effective in this, and he's being very tactful to pacify someone who's somewhat complaining about the fact that they didn't get to get in there with everybody else and fight the whole battle. Yes, that would have been the honor. Very good point, Freddie. All right. So Gideon was successful in calming them down. Notice again in verse 3, who gets the credit? What does he say? He says, the Lord. God has given the leaders. He's not into this, okay, now let's see who did what. You did this, but we did this. No, God's responsible for it all. And I think there's a point to make here. Sometimes keeping peace on our side is more challenging than defeating the enemy. If you ever lead any kind of group of people, elders have to contend with this. Those who run businesses, even in the household. I mean, we sort of have a team, and we're all trying to go together on this thing. But somewhere along the line, what does somebody start hollering about? Well, I'm not getting my fair share here. Maybe I'm underappreciated, and of course, if someone's being underappreciated, that's a separate issue, and that needs to be dealt with. But if someone just feels like, I'm not getting the respect that I think I deserve, what have they lost sight of? The goal. The collective goal. The work that God wants done, and that is, of course, irrespective of who does what. If you're interested in jotting some verses, then I think you can make some good points along the lines of 1 Corinthians and also Romans 12. We just got through studying Romans. But particularly the discussion in the 1 Corinthians 12. The Corinthian Christians were arguing in those three chapters over what part of the work. Their spiritual gifts. They were pitting one gift against another. And just to sort of paraphrase those passages, Paul says, God has put these gifts as He desires in different people in the body. Each body part has its own function. No one body part is more important than the other. In fact, he later on says in that context, the eye cannot say to the hand, I have no need of thee. The head can't say to the foot, I don't need you. Every part has a function. So the Ephraimites played a vital part in this. Gideon played a vital part. The men who were, the 300 men, they played a vital part. All that mattered was what? The victory over the oppressor, which was Midian. Whatever part a person or a group of people played in the grand scheme is really irrelevant, as long as God, of course, got the glory. That's still a battle we fight in the Lord's kingdom today. And we have to watch that. That's an attitude that God does not approve. All right. Now that's just going through the first three verses. Let's look now at verses 4 through 17. And let's talk about the men from Gad, or the Gadites, as we'll call them. Well, it's obvious when you come to verses 4 and 5, particularly, Gideon's still doing what? He's still chasing. He's still pursuing. So not everyone has been dealt with of the enemy. So as they're pursuing, and I should have put a map up here, but as you can see it, where is Gad? It's on the east side of the Jordan. They were part of the 2.5 tribes that stayed over there when they divided up the land, as you remember. Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh. And so they have crossed the Jordan. So Gideon and his men have come east where Ephraim had cut off the Jordan, so they've dealt with them now. Now he goes on further east and goes over into Gad. And he's still chasing. And what request does Gideon make? Yeah. He said, look, we're just worn out. We're weary. We're chasing this enemy. We sure would appreciate it if you give us some provisions. My version uses the word provisions here in verse 5. Please give loaves of bread to the people. who are following me, for they are weary. I am pursuing Zeba and Zalmunna. These are the kings of Midian. So he asked for help. Now, he didn't ask for soldiers. He didn't ask for volunteers, did he? He just asked for some help. Let us have the sustenance we need for our journey here while we continue this chase. A legitimate request? Yes, absolutely. Well, what was the response? What did the men of Succoth say? Now, the two cities of Gad were Succoth and Penuel. Again, if you get a map out, maybe you have one in your Bible, you'll see them in Gad, which is east of the Jordan. What was their response? Yeah, I said, well, have you caught them yet? Have you finished them yet? And the reason for them asking that is, what was their concern? That's right. Now, if you don't have them yet, and we help you, and you wind up losing this battle, then they'll come back and they'll really get on us. And so, I think we're just going to play it safe, and we're not going to help you. For the fear that they won't come back to get us in the end, if you don't get the job done. In fact, the question in verse 6, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hands that we should give bread to your army? So it's obvious that they feared, and the same thing is said. Look in verse 8. Gideon went up from there, that is from Succoth, to Penuel, and spoke similarly to them, and the men of Penuel answered him just as the men of Succoth had answered. So they said the same thing. We're not going to help you either. So these two groups of Gadites, they feared a Midianite reprisal, that is to say, a response, a vengeance, if you will, if they helped Gideon. They feared that more than they had confidence in Gideon. In fact, for the moment, look down at verse 15. We'll get there just in a few moments. But when Gideon goes back to deal with the men of Succoth, how did Gideon view their words? Ridicule, verse 15. Behold, Zeba and Zalmunna, concerning whom you taunted me, my version says. Ridicule. So that's how Gideon felt about their statement. It was a taunt. It wasn't just a lack of confidence. They were mocking him. No faith in him whatsoever. That's how Gideon viewed it. And absolutely. They were worn out. And yeah, that's right. No bus, no. And whose work are they doing? Well, they're doing God's work. I mean, they're not out here on their own. God has called them to this service. So, unmoved. Now, Gideon didn't get what he wanted or what he needed, but he's unmoved. What does he say? He doesn't say if. He says when. It's going to happen. When I get this job done, I'm going to come back and I'm going to deal with you. He tells the men of Succoth that, and he tells the men of Penuel that. There will be punishment. I'll see to that. So a stern warning, if you will. He would punish both those groups of men. And again, verse 15, he viewed their words of refusal to help to him and his men as a taunt or a ridicule, your version would have. What does the old King James say in verse 15? Same thing? Ridicule or mocking? Upbraiding? Okay. All right. So that's how he deals with the two men of, or the two towns of Gad. Again, they had no faith in Gideon. Well, Gideon's chasing Zeba and Zalmunna, Midianite kings. They've got 15,000 troops with them still. That's his verse 10. How many has already fallen? 120,000. So 135,000. That's where we got our size of the enemy from on Sunday, was from verse 10. So he finally comes to them, verse 11. He again attacks the camp when they are unsuspecting. And he captures the two kings, verse 11 and 12, and he routs the whole army. Another slaughter, another defeat for the Midianites, and he captures the two kings. Okay. He captures them. He goes back to Succoth and Penuel, and what does he do? Just like he said he was going to do. Now, what did he do at Succoth? Excuse me? He taught them. Okay. He whipped them with thorns. Verse 16, took the elders of the city and thorns of the wilderness and briars, and he disciplined the men of Succoth. He whipped them, spanked them, put a lot of pain on them. But what did he do at Penuel? Tore down the tower and killed the men or the elders of the city. Maybe a reference to the leading men of the city. Was it all the men or leading men? Whoever it was, he actually took the lives of men. Why do you think that Penuel received the greater punishment? That's a good question. He took no lives out of Succoth. He just whipped them. But he actually killed men of Penuel. The Bible is silent about that. But for some reason, Gideon, perhaps the Lord told him, it's not stated, but Penuel deserved the greater punishment. But be that as it may, he had said earlier in Penuel, did he not, up in verse 9, when I return safely, I will tear down this tower. And that's what he did. He tore down their tower or their monument in their city. So, a good point. Since these two cities sided with the enemy and even acted like the enemy, taunting him, how is Gideon going to treat them like the enemy? That's how he treated them. And he dealt with them on that way. Let me read you a quote I pulled out of one of my books, one of my commentaries. I thought the author who wrote this put this in a pretty good way. The final defeat of the Midianites was achieved basically without the enthusiastic support of God's people. The Ephraimites were more concerned about their tribal status, and I think by implication also the spoil, than they were about smashing the enemy. The Transjordan cities of Succoth and Penuel chose neutrality. They refused to help, rather than jeopardize their own security. Everyone wants to join the victory parade. That's true, isn't it? Few are willing to hazard their lives in the heat of battle. A wise warrior will expect disappointment from God's people. Now, not the enemy, but from God's people. But he will nonetheless press on to victory. I thought that was well put. We're dealing here with Israelites, those from Ephraim, and their focus was not on the victory, but on you've insulted us. You didn't use us. And the Gadites, again, Israelites from the tribal area of Gad, they refused to help. They wouldn't get involved. What did Jesus say? He who is not with me is against me. There is no sideline area with Jesus. I mean, it's either you're there or you're not. And here we see the same situation facing Gideon on this occasion, and that Jesus warns us about in the New Testament. Okay, so I thought there was a good point to make here. Gideon had a justified expectation from others. Namely, this is about the Gadites. It was not unfair for him to expect them to help him. And they refused. And that's disappointing. So sometimes we see in the Lord's body, again, there's those who are busy about the Lord's work, and an issue rises up, and times get a little tight, corners get a little antsy, and we need those who are involved in this need some help, and they reach out to the brethren to help, and sometimes the answer is what? I don't want to help. They refuse to take a stand on something, and kind of leave brethren like that sort of out to dry. Well, it's still going to get done. Those that love the Lord will find a way to do the Lord's work. But sometimes it's rather disappointing. And maybe some of us have been in that very situation in the past. If you've not been, I would suspect that someday you will be if you stay busy about the Lord's work. Okay. Any further comments to verse 17 on the Gadites, the men of the cities of Succoth and Penuel? Yeah, that's the King James Version. He taught them. New King James says this is verse 16, he taught them. Mine says he disciplined them with thorns and briars. You know, sometimes you get stuck or jabbed with a briar or a thorn, and that hurts. But to be whipped, can you imagine what that must have felt like? Have a have a big brush of them, or maybe they were interwoven into like a band, and to be disciplined with like with a whip. I don't think that felt too good. A peach tree limb. Well, okay, you're showing your age, Brother Lambert. Okay, let's talk now about Zeba and Zalmunna. Yes, okay. Verses 18 through 21. Now, these are the two kings, the two Midianite kings that Gideon had been chasing. He captured them. And he's sort of delayed dealing with them while he's been dealing with the Gadites. So they're all through. Now it's time to deal with these two kings. And he comes to them, and he has a question. What does he ask them? Those men that you killed at Tabor, what kind of men were they? Pardon? Yes. They said, well, they were each one like you. Or they resembled you, Gideon, each one resembling the son of a king. Well, what did Gideon know about these men? All right. Particularly, they were his half-brothers, weren't they? Indication by what he says in verse 19, they were the sons of my mother, obviously by different fathers. So not all 100% brothers, but half-brothers. But they were kin. Gideon viewed them as kin. And he said, well, they were kin of mine. And what was Gideon's next words to them? All right. If you had shown kindness or compassion to them, then I was going to deal with you kindly. But since you did not, then guess what's coming? I'm going to take your life now. Vengeance or revenge. God using Gideon in so many words to bring about judgment on these two men. So he says, I'd be willing to let you live, but you had not shown that to my brothers. So he told his eldest son, Jether. Now, one writer that I read, and it doesn't say in verse 18, but he believes that Gideon is now back at Ophrah, back in his hometown, because his son Jether is there. And even though the verse says in verse 20 that he was his firstborn, how old was Jether? He was still a youth. Now, we don't know how old a youth is, but he was not a full-grown man. And this writer is suggesting, he says, to me it's doubtful that he would have let Jether be among those 300 men to make that long excursion and hunt these men down. So he has brought these two princes back to Ophrah. That's not stated. That very well could be the case. I just thought I'd throw that out there for you to think about. Wherever they are, it doesn't make any difference. He tells Jether, rise up and kill these men. Wonder why he told Jether to do that. Why not Gideon just do it? All right, it'd be an honor for Jether and a disgrace to these two men killed by a youth. Another way to disgrace these men. What was Jether's answer? I can't do it. I'm too afraid. He was afraid to do it. So, then what did these two men say? Listen, Gideon, if you're going to be a man about this, Brother Miller says, why don't you do it? In fact, their statement was what? What did they tell him? That's the one I wanted. That's in verse 21. For as the man, so is his strength. Now, Gideon, if you're not going to do it, then you're not much of a man. That's really what they're saying. And that's all Gideon needed to hear. What did he do? He killed them right there on the spot. Executed them right there. And he also did something else. So Jether was too afraid. So after Gideon killed them, then what did he do? All right, he took the spoils. In this case, it's mentioned in the record, he took the crescent ornaments that were hanging about the necks of the camels that they rode on. Now, these must have been pretty fancy ornaments to drape it over the neck of a camel. It showed their royalty. It showed who they were, that it was the beast of a king. All those indications, I think, come into play. Obviously, it was worth something for Gideon to take it. So he seized Zeba's ornament, and he seized also Zalmunna's ornament. And that was the end of these two enemies. So we're dealing with these people as we go through the chapter. The Ephraimites, the Gadites, the two kings. Now we come back to more Israelites, verses 22 through 26. And this takes us on to page 18, is question 6 now. All right? Well, what was the interaction between Gideon and the men of Israel? All right, the fight is pretty much over. The reason for which God raised up Gideon is pretty much been taken care of. He slaughtered the Midianites. He, for all intents and purposes, he has redeemed Israel from Midianite oppression. So now that all that's over, the men of Israel say, Gideon, we have an offer for you. Why don't you just be a ruler to us? They didn't use the word king in the text, but I think that's one of the indications. To rule over us, and not just you rule, but they even offered Gideon, you can start your own dynasty. Because they said what? Your son, just let it fall on through your bloodline. After you, then your son, then your grandson, and so on. I mean, we're willing to just submit everything to you right now and let you set up a kingdom, if you will. What was Gideon's response? I'm not interested in that. In fact, he says what? So you've got a ruler. Who does that sound like, by the way? We're not to it yet in the Samuel. When Israel demanded the king, and it says that the thing displeased Samuel because he says, you have a king already. God is your king. They just couldn't see him. They couldn't see the king. All the other nations, they had their kings going out to war and so forth. Israel didn't have a king. Well, Gideon says, you've got a ruler. So I'm not interested in that position. You need to submit to the Lord as your ruler. That takes us at least through verse 23. So he says, I'm not willing to do that, but what was he willing to do? All right. Yeah. So he said, let's get back to this spoil again. I tell you what we will do is each of you bring me a gold earring from the spoil. And he doesn't say I'll consider that payment, but that's what he asked for. That's in verse 24. They had gold earrings because they were Ishmaelites. And they said, we will surely give them, verse 25, so they spread out a garment. Each one, it says, threw an earring there from his spoil. What was the weight of the gold? 1,700 shekels of gold. What I could find, this was anywhere between 43 and 50 pounds of gold. You might know what the current price of gold is by the ounce right now? 1,300? How many ounces in a pound? I mean, do the math. Okay, I mean, this is a lot of money. This is a boatload of money. So instantly, Gideon became a very wealthy man with this spoil. And again, this may have been what was in the mind of the Ephraimites, because when you went out to battle and you won, you got a lot of spoils, a lot of riches and wealth. Of course, depending on who it was that you were defeating, some nations were richer than others, but sometimes the spoils were very, very lucrative. That's true. Like, yes, the things that he got off of camels from the kings. Yes. Verse 26, besides the shekels of gold, there's the crescents, the robes which were on the kings, and other things that sort of made up this pile of wealth, if you will. So the windfall from Gideon's efforts here were certainly paying off at this time. Well, what did Gideon do with the gold? He obviously melted it down, obviously, and fashioned it into a what? An ephod. Now, what's an ephod? Okay, it's that breastplate-like part of the high priest's garments that you can read about in the Old Testament. And someone asked the question, well, what is Gideon wanting with an ephod? Is he going to start acting like a priest? Well, the text doesn't say that, but why would he make an ephod? He set it up for some reason. Well, we may not know why he did. In fact, we don't know why he did it. But we do know something. What does the story tell us? Okay, it became a snare. It became a big problem, not just for Israel, but verse 27 says, for who also? For Gideon and his house or his family. They all started to bow down to this thing, this ephod, and began to worship with it, began to worship it. This is a sad reality that we see in this story, and we see it elsewhere in the Bible. Sometimes something is carried too far, and it becomes very, very harmful. In 2 Kings chapter 18 and verse 4, just doing a real quick read at that place, you have the reforms of Hezekiah, great king. But he had to tear something down that had been hanging around for a long time. Remember what it was, anybody? It was that brass serpent that who fashioned? Moses. In Numbers 21, what was the purpose of that brass serpent? Yeah, to cure snake bites. They had these fiery serpents that were going in among the people because they were complaining, and God heard enough. They said, all right, here come the serpents. And so he told Moses, people were just dropping like flies, weren't they? Fashion this brass serpent, put it on a pole, and set it up. If anyone's bitten by the brass serpent, if he did what? If he looked at the brass serpent on the pole, then you would live. And so that was the purpose that it served. But apparently, what had Israel done with that thing? Well, they kept it. It just sort of lingered around all those years. And finally, what did it become? An idol. And now we have this ephod. Why Gideon fashioned it, the Bible doesn't say. But now, if he fashioned it to worship it, then that's wrong right from the get-go. But I'm not saying that he did. But whatever the reason was why he made it, why he wanted it, that's what became of it. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yes. All the times that he has given credit to God, he's told the men of Israel, I will not be your ruler. It's God who's your ruler. That doesn't sound like a man who's interested in setting up an idol. Now, again, the Bible doesn't say. Okay. Perhaps it was a thing of pride, a thing of boasting. Again, all these are at least legitimate ideas to think about. We cannot say for sure why, but we can say for sure what eventuated was a problem. Not just for him and for his house, but for the entire nation. They did play the harlot with it. They did bow down to it. So that was a bad way to end this story, if you will. Verse 28, it says that Gideon brought rest to the land following the subjugation or the defeat of Midian. In fact, if you do if you have one of these Bible search programs on the computer, you can type in a phrase like, however your version has it, that the land enjoyed rest, the land had rest. This is the last time you'll see this phrase in the rest of the book. You won't see it anymore. Which is an indication that what's going to happen the rest of the years of the judges following Gideon. Constant turmoil. Constant friction. Constant oppression. No more rest will be given to the land, as it's been stated, I think two times prior to this it was stated in the book of Judges. It would be undisturbed rest for 40 years in the remaining days of Gideon following his victory over the Midianites. Yes, right. Because of their continued idolatry and their continued harlotry to the Lord. Okay. Let's look at Gideon's last days real quickly, verses 29 through 32. He went, and the text just says he spent his last days at his house, so he lived a rather private life. He'd been out here in the public, doing all this warring and delivering. So he's just going to sort of, I don't want to use the word retire, but he's going to live a more private life, if you will. He was a polygamist. He had many wives, by which he fathered 70 sons. Is that in accordance with the will of God from the garden? No, it's not. So that was a problem. He had concubines in addition to his wives. And by one concubine, unnamed concubine, was she named? I don't think she was she? She was in Shechem. But to this concubine was born who? Abimelech. Let's focus on Abimelech just for the moment because he's the next story in the book of Judges. His name means, "My father is king." Now, another alternate translation would be, "Father of a king." But if it means this, why would Gideon have named him that when he said earlier what? "I'm not going to be your king. Nor my sons." So already we're seeing, could Gideon's later years, could he have been thinking somewhat differently than he was earlier? Could be. Could be. Well, it could have been named by his mother. But, maybe she thought Gideon to be a king. I hadn't thought about that, Freddie. Maybe that's so. At any rate, that's what his name means. And Abimelech would be the only, and that's my phrase, a non-judge ruler. He was never called a judge. The story never says that God raised him up. Doesn't say that. But God did use him. And basically, what kind of man was Abimelech? He was worthless. He was a scoundrel. Very unscrupulous. And we'll study about him, Lord willing, on Sunday morning. Judges chapter 9. Okay. Well, let's look at the last of the chapter of following Gideon's death, verses 33 through 35. Gideon has died now. What do we see? The cycle again. Back to the idolatry. That 40 years of rest has come to an end now. And remember what we read back in chapter 2 and verse 19. That was one of the introductions to the book before we started getting into the stories themselves. Verse 19 of chapter 2. "It came about when the judge died that they, Israel, would turn back and act more corruptly than their fathers. In following other gods to serve them and bow down to them, they did not abandon their practices or their stubborn ways." So again, this cycle again repeats itself. You go right back to the mud hole, if you will. And so once again, they forgot God back in chapter 8, now verse 34. "They did not remember the Lord their God who had delivered them from their hands of all their enemies on every side." He had just brought them through the hand of Gideon. They just brought them out of their oppression. They forgot about that. And then verse 35 says they forgot something else too. Gideon. They forgot Gideon. Verse 35. It says all the good that he had done for them, they forgot him, didn't show kindness to his house that was left after him. They just were, you know, this mindset, "What have you done for me lately?" That's so prevailing in the world. Back when he was alive and when Gideon was needed, well, how much did they think of him? So much that they wanted to make him their ruler. But now that he's gone, and we sort of, you know, history kind of does that to us, where is it now? Gideon who? Yes, Doug. Well, I mean, it could, yes. When you see these statements like we see there in verse 28, that the land had rest for 40 years, there's always some overlapping in the book of Judges. You know, it's not just like chunks here and then chunks here and chunks here. So whatever this 40 years was it 40 years after Gideon's victory? That's how I take verse 28. And for 40 years to pass, well, that's true. Which, how would you help future generations to remember? You tell them, you teach those stories. That's always so critical in the Old Testament. That's a good point to bring out, Doug. All right, before class ends, let me do something that Freddie has brought up a couple of times, and I just wanted recognize this fact that when we look at the ways that the judges have been redeeming Israel, it's not all been in the same place. I know this is a really small map. Up there, it seems that when Othniel took care of Cush and Rishathaim of Mesopotamia, it's looking about the old area of Aram, or Syria, which is up there to the north. Well, after he took care of that, Ehud comes. He delivers them from Eglon, or king of Moab, which is down there. See, it's not all in the same area. After Ehud, Shamgar took care of the Philistines. So they're on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea. There were the Ashdod and Ashkelon and Gaza, all those Philistine cities. They were the ones who would come to the east and oppress the people of Israel. And then the last three judges, Deborah and Barak, and Gideon were also over here in the same area. Deborah and Barak went to war around Mount Tabor, where they defeated, who was that again? They defeated chapter 4. Jabin, king of Canaan. And then Gideon, of course, was over here at Mount Moriah. And he, of course, defeated the Midianites. And by the way, the Midianites are way down here off the map, opposite the Sinai Peninsula. So they're not even up in the Canaan area. So again, that map just shows us that these oppressions happened all over the map in Israel. And it's not all in one centralized location. And as one area would suffer, then God would send this judge. Another area would suffer, God would send that judge. But it's the same cycle throughout the book, as we see from story to story. Okay. We'll pick up, Lord willing, on Sunday morning with chapter 9, the story of Abimelech.